If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic. Teddy bear who's been good is sure of a treat today. There's lots of marvelous things to eat and wonderful games to play. Beneath the trees where nobody sees, they'll hide and seek as long as they please. That's the way the teddy bears have their picnic. Picnic time for teddy bears. The little teddy bears are having a lovely time today. Watch them, catch them unawares, and see them picnic on their holiday. See them gaily gad about, they love to play and shout, they never have any cares. At 6 o'clock their mummies and daddies will take them home to bed, 'cause they're tired little teddy bears.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. That was Henry Hall and his orchestra with The Teddy Bear's Picnic, which J.G. Ballard said was his favorite song when he was asked by The Guardian a few years ago. I'm playing an interview from 1994 with the author. After the interview, the Atrocity Exhibition by Joy Division, named after a J.G. Ballard novel originally called Love and Napalm Export USA.
The next interview moves diagonally across London to Shepperton, and the home of another unparalleled and subversive giant of contemporary English literature, the late J.G. Ballard. Listening to this compelling, sometimes disturbing conversation again, I'm immediately transported back to the moment we found his shabby, rather rubbish-strewn suburban front door, with the passenger aircraft coming in and out of Heathrow thundering just above our heads, like some semi-apocalyptic techno disaster from one of Ballard's novels, just waiting to happen. The man came to the door looking like he usually does, a disgraced down-at-heel accountant, but embraced us with a huge amount of whisky and soda-driven bonhomie. We picked our way through the cluttered flat to his front room, which was normally decorated, apart from the huge and sexually explicit surrealist painting just above the mantelpiece. And then, whisky and sodas in hand, we began to tackle his enormous literary achievement. Mind-bending fictions like Crash, The Atrocity Exhibition and The Drowned World, which frighten us with images of technology, violence and sexuality, fused into horrific but prophetic combinations. His fictionalised memoirs, Empire of the Sun and The Kindness of Woman, the former turned into a powerful movie by Steven Spielberg. And on his general musings on the techno-psychological weirdness of the 20th century, where our own inventions and innovations come to haunt our dreams and exploit our erotic energies, offering paradise on earth, but always threatening a wasteland of junk and destruction underneath. I also have to commend the startling production of this programme by Ian Doherty, at times, in its use of sound and quotations, itself approaching a work of radio art. If you're listening at bedtime, I suggest you pull the duvet right up over your head and stay there for the next 50 minutes. It's going to be a long, strange trip. Here's J.G. Ballard. Welcome. There are two writers called J.G. Ballard, one overground and popular, and one very underground indeed. Ballard's best-selling 1984 novel, Empire of the Sun, has been acclaimed as a classic of post-war British autobiography, a memoir of his days as an abandoned child in a Shanghai prisoner of war camp during World War II. It also provided the script for one of Steven Spielberg's better blockbusters. Yet the Ballard of the preceding three decades is a much less mainstream creature. This Ballard is the violent futurist of English letters, mixing dark surrealism and glittering technology, and coming up with extreme tales of sex and brutality that still shock to this day. His most notorious 1972 novel, Crash, which takes as its premise that car crashes are sexually exciting, is about to be released as a movie by David Cronenberg, who previously filmed or attempted to film William Burroughs' novel, The Naked Lunch. The imagination runs wild. Ballard has a new book of essays out, immodestly titled A User's Guide to the Millennium. And if anyone can provide some directions out of the century of Hiroshima and Dealey Plaza, Marilyn Monroe and Rosemary West, then it's James Graham Ballard. I met him at his cosy suburban semi in Shepperton, and we began with Empire of the Sun. J.G. Ballard, you've written in an extraordinary range and style of works over the years, but the book and the film which most people will know you for is Empire of the Sun, which is a conventional memoir of your childhood experiences in Shanghai during the Second World War. Did you have any idea that that particular book would make such an impact?
Not while I was writing it, no. I mean, I was absolutely amazed by the reception of the book when it was published. People say, of course, it's very different from everything else you've written. But to me, it wasn't. I mean, it was semi-autobiographical in the way that my earlier novels weren't. But it was basically a book, an imaginative response to, you know, the subject matter, in the way that all my novels have been. Of course, it was a very important book for me because it... Not because it was successful, though that was you know, a very pleasant thing to happen to any novelist. But it opened sort of windows that, in my mind, that had been closed for 40 years. I mean, it was a very, very long time to wait, something like 40 years, before, you know, I wrote about my wartime experiences. I never understood to this day why I... you know, waited so long. And of course I realised, once I'd written Empire of the Sun, I realised that there were traces of my wartime experiences present, though I'd never realised it in all my earlier novels, that there were, that for some reason I'd suppressed my memories of the war, but they'd nonetheless come through the, you know, the paving stones I'd laid down. And once I'd written Empire of the Sun, I suddenly realised, my God, of course, I can see in the drowned world and the crystal world and Crash and High Rise and so on. I can see, and in all my short stories, I can see my past like a kind of almost invisible guest at a party. And when I wrote Empire of the Sun, I held that guest in my hands and, you know, recognized him as my younger self.
From Empire of the Sun by J.G. Ballard. Jim had tried to tell his mother about his dreams, but like all the adults in Shanghai that winter of 1941, she was too preoccupied to listen to him. Perhaps she had bad dreams of her own. In an eerie way, these shuffled images of tanks and dive bombers were completely silent, as if his sleeping mind was trying to separate the real war from the make-believe conflicts invented by Pathé and British Movie Tone. Jim had no doubt which was real. The real war was everything he had seen for himself since the Japanese invasion of China in 1937. The old battlegrounds at Hungzhou and Lunhua, where the bones of the unburied dead rose to the surface of the paddy fields each spring. Real war was the thousands of Chinese refugees dying of cholera in the sealed stockades at Hutong, and the bloody heads of communist soldiers mounted in pikes along the Bund. In a real war, no one knew which side he was on. And there were no flags or commentators or winners. In a real war, there were no enemies.
So you went back to Shanghai. These are always strange experiences when, you know, you go back to a great moment that shaped you at a very vulnerable age. Briefly, what was that like?
I went back to Shanghai for the first time in 1991 with a BBC TV film crew, and I was there for about a week. We revisited the house where I lived and then the camp, and actually filmed inside the very room that I shared with my parents and my sister. That was an extraordinary experience, of course. I mean, Shanghai, the house I lived in and the camp were all exactly as I remembered them, because I was nervous of going, in a way, because I thought they're likely to be nothing like my memories, in which case I'd been living with a complete, you know, a complete myth. But in fact, they were there, like a sort of intact stage set. Mm. I think what was missing was my own emotions, my own memories, in a way, were too accurate. I hadn't the sort of unresolved emotions that I still feel when I visit, say, very occasionally visit Cambridge University, which I disliked intensely. And I know that my dislike of Cambridge University has never really been resolved. So whenever I briefly pass Cambridge or drive through it, I feel a kind of, you know, the gears of my hostility grinding together. Now, that didn't happen in Shanghai, because there were no unresolved emotions. It was as if I'd only been away a day. It wasn't a sort of pregnant homecoming which released a huge flood of sort of anguished material. It was as if I'd dropped by after a quick trip down to Hong Kong. it was a very moving experience, all the same.
Mm. Honestly, what do you think that experience did to you as a child?
Well, like all extraordinary experiences, particularly during wartime, it had its harrowing side, but it also had in many ways, a very beneficial effect on my makeup. Some people might say that's a stupid thing to say, you could have been killed, and that's true. But given that I was there, given that I was present during the Japanese fighting around Shanghai from 1937 onwards, and then interned by them during the war, on the one hand, it gave me a very realistic view of the world. I never had any patience with the view that the Americans were wrong to drop the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, I had no sympathy with the CND movements, you know, after the war, all those marches from Aldermaston struck me like a sort of glorified children's crusade.
Why?
Well, they were ignoring the reality of the world that we lived in. The, you know, nuclear weapons have kept the peace between the superpowers, and our own comparatively small nuclear strike force would have been a last desperate, you know, counterattack if we were ever threatened with attack by the Soviet Union.
Do you think that applies in Hiroshima and Nagasaki as well?
Absolutely. I mean, tragically, you know, a couple of 100,000 Japanese died in those two cities. But those deaths were nothing by comparison with the number that would have died had the Americans and British been obliged to fight their way up through Singapore and Hong Kong and Saigon and Shanghai. I mean, the one major city the Americans had to fight for during the Second World War was Manila in the Philippines. During about 2 months of ferocious fighting, I think something like 20,000 Japanese soldiers died, but over 100,000 Filipino civilians were just butchered by Japanese troops running amok. More than died on the first day at Hiroshima. During the American landings on Okinawa, which is very close to the Japanese home islands, something like 200,000 Japanese civilians died. I think the atomic bomb saved lives. And also, of course, they have a sort of apocalyptic significance that touches a sort of mythic level of our imaginations. I mean, this is, primitive man inventing fire.
Have you always been obsessed with technology?
I'm not sure if I have been obsessed by technology. I've been very interested in it, and it's touched my imagination in a way that isn't really the done thing in England. The Scots have always been great engineers. but the English have always looked down, really, on engineering and technology to their cost. And I was brought up in Shanghai, which was an American zone of influence, and I think I always had an American view of technology. I regard it as optimistic, a good thing, makes life more interesting, allows you to get on with more, other things. I've never turned my back against it, as I think so many English do, even to this day. I mean, we live in a world that has been almost entirely remade by science and technology. This covers almost every part of our lives, from, the most basic, from motorways and the motor car to high-tech hospitals and airports to the sort of invisible technologies of data processing, microwave links that are transmitting our bank balances and TV programs. We're surrounded by advanced and more and more invisible technologies. And one can't ignore them. One's got to respond imaginatively to them if one's a writer or painter. And I've always tried to do that. Now, I began as a science fiction writer, but in many ways, my interest in science and technology has nothing to do with science fiction at all. If what we think of as genre science fiction, the American SF of the post-war period, a lot of it written by British writers, if you try to imagine genre SF never existing, I would still have been just as interested in science and technology, and I think my fiction would have contained a lot of elements of it.
From the Atrocity Exhibition by J.G. Ballard. Captain Webster studied the prints. They showed, one, a thick-set man in an Air Force jacket, unshaven face half-hidden by the dented hat peak. Two, a transverse section through the spinal level T12. Three, a crayon self-portrait by David Feary, 7-year-old schizophrenic at the Belmont Asylum, Sutton. Four, radio spectra from the quasar DTA-102. 5. An anterior-posterior radiograph of a skull, estimated capacity 1500 cc. 6. Spectroheliogram of the sun, taken with the K-line of calcium. 7. Left and right handprints, showing massive scarring between second and third metacarpal bones. To Dr. Nathan, he said, "And all these make up one picture."
I mean, the other book which a mass audience is about to know you for, given that David Cronenberg is in putting together a film about it at the moment, is Crash. It was written in the early 70s. Now, this is a book about people who get erotic satisfaction from car crashes and their victims. It's still a controversial and challenging subject. I want to ask you, what effect were you trying to induce with that book? I mean, what did you want us to see with that book that people hadn't seen or understood before?
I think I wanted to force people to face up to the fact that, that human beings find violence intensely exciting, that it touches the imagination in all kinds of ways, which may well be beneficial, horrific though it is to imagine that. I mean, there is no doubt that we are obsessed with violence, that we do find it enormously exciting. I wrote that book in 1972 at a time when, thanks to the liberation brought about by the 60s, our television and cinema screens were just saturated by images of violence of every kind. We'd had the Kennedy assassination, we had the Vietnam War, we had wars in gruesome civil wars in places like Biafra, Nigeria, with graphic material, newsreel material being shown on our TV screens every night, which you never see now, public executions and tortures of various kinds. Now, this cinema screens were full of violent car crashes. I didn't invent the car crash. I remember seeing images of the Kennedy assassination, of this comparatively young man with his wife beside him having his head blown off as he rode in a motorcade through Dallas. I remember seeing this used as a backdrop to sort of rock programs on TV, and even once, I think, to a program about fashion. It may have been a magazine layout, but I thought, what is going on? People are, obviously unalienated from all this violence. They're embracing it. It's irrigating their imaginations in totally unexpected ways. What strange flower is going to bloom from this irrigation? And I thought, I've got to look at this. This is a subject worth exploring. And I thought, well, what I'll do is adopt the, Jonathan Swift's approach in A Modest Proposal. I'll take for granted from the very first word of the novel that car crashes are sexually fulfilling and life-enhancing. I'll take that nightmare logic, a psychotic logic, and see where it leads me. And I wrote it as a single parent bringing up three very young children who are crossing the road every day to wherever very young children go. And, of course, nature could have played a horrifically bad joke on me. Fortunately, it didn't. But anyway, I clung to my sort of first objective. I wrote this novel, which is a psychopathic hymn. There's no question about that. Utterly without any sort of moral redemption. But it is a psychopathic hymn with a point. And that's what I think gives it some merit, that it does look frankly at where our obsession with technological violence may lead us.
From Crash by J.G. Ballard. In his vision of a car crash with the actress Elizabeth Taylor, Vaughan was obsessed by many wounds and impacts, by the dying chromium and collapsing bulkheads of their two cars meeting head-on in complex collisions endlessly repeated in slow-motion films, by the identical wounds inflicted on their bodies, by the image of windshield glass frosting around her face as she broke its tinted surface like a death-born Aphrodite, by the compound fractures of their thighs impacted against their handbrake mountings, and above all, by the wounds to their genitalia, her uterus pierced by the heraldic beak of the manufacturer's medallion, his semen emptying across the luminescent dials that registered forever the last temperature and fuel levels of the engine.
The spectacles of ultraviolence that we see in present-day cinema wouldn't be possible without the technology that drives them forward. They tap a very different set of needs and drives in our minds. And of course, that's what I'm primarily concerned with. I'm not singing the praises of the washing machine or the coffee grinder. I'm much more interested in what happens when our imaginations come into play. I mean, when one thinks about Crash, the important thing is to distinguish between the fact that, obviously, car crashes are not sexually exciting. I've been in a car crash and there's no sexual excitement involved whatsoever. But the idea of car crashes is sexually exciting. Now, that's a very different, a more serious matter, in a way. The fact that we find the spectacle of car crashes, or the thought even of car crashes, sexually exciting, or exciting, or at least appealing to our emotions on one or other levels. Now, that is a much more sinister and worrying phenomenon. But there's no doubt that it's true. Otherwise, well, you know, hundreds of American films churned out by Hollywood or virtually, you know, every year would not be full of violent car crashes or violent killings.
But it's interesting the way that your interest, some would say even bravery in approaching these issues, has often resulted in a judgment of yourself. I mean, one of the classic reviews of Crash was, this man is beyond mental curative powers. He cannot be psychiatrized. He is, you know, terminally insane. You can understand the way that when you write about this stuff,
The publisher's reader, who was herself the wife of a well-known psychiatrist, and her report was, the author is beyond psychiatric help. And I thought at the time, well, that represents complete artistic success. Since I'd adopted the sort of Jonathan Swift Modest Proposal approach, I thought, well, that I've succeeded if she believes that, because I know that I'm not in any way beyond psychiatric help. I don't even need any psychiatric help. I knew that I'd pulled it off as far as I was concerned. In fact, I'd never read the book since I wrote it. Since reading the proof, I'd never read the book. I mean, it's far too frightening. I mean, it was a kit of desperate measures in a way.
I was reading through a selection of your short stories and novels. There's a lot of dissection. There's a lot of detailed appreciation of the human body and its physiology, even in autobiographical novels, right up to The Kindness of Woman. Is this to do with the fact that you were trained as a doctor?
Yes, it is. I mean, I never completed my medical studies because the pressures to become a writer were just too great. And I felt I'd taken enough from the first couple of years when I was studying anatomy in particular, but also physiology. To give me a stock of metaphors, because yes, I had this wonderful 2 years of studying medicine gave me this wonderful treasure store of metaphors and similes based on the human body that I've gone on using throughout my fiction. And I've always felt that, you know, having dissected cadavers, which is a very profoundly moving experience to dissect a cadaver. When I was a medical student, most of the cadavers were donated by doctors before their deaths. And it was a great tribute to the spirit of these dead physicians, mostly men with a few women, that they were prepared to endow their bodies so that the next generation, their successors, could be trained, particularly as they knew what would happen to those cadavers, that they would end up as a little clutch of bones and gristle, like the sort of remnants of a Sunday roast, and that their flesh would, you know, endure for many months the sort of ribald humour of the dissecting room. I think it was a great, you know, tribute to these men and women, that they gave their bodies, you know, to the next generation of doctors, and I was well aware of it as I dissected them. And of course, you're in intimate contact with a human being in a way that you can never be otherwise, because you're literally dismantling the flesh. I mean, you dismantle a face, revealing the layers of muscles that make up the everyday expressions of pleasure and surprise and anger. You see the machinery of the emotions. That's very instructive in its own right, but it taught me to respect the human body and the human spirit that lies behind it. A lesson I wouldn't have learned otherwise. And it meant a lot to me in particular, because Of course, only a few years beforehand, 3 or 4 years beforehand, I'd seen thousands of bodies on the streets of Shanghai and in the battlegrounds around Shanghai. I mean, I'd seen them since my earliest childhood, since the age of 7, since 1937, when there was bitter fighting all around Shanghai. And we'd go out and see, look at, like tourists, to look at the battlefields, and we'd see the dead lying, mutilated dead lying in the fields, legs waving in the canals. And becoming a medical student, I felt I was sort of redeeming some of those meaningless dead lying in those wretched paddy fields. So it was a profoundly moving experience, one I hope I've reflected in my writing.
From the Atrocity Exhibition by J.G. Ballard. In a sense, Dr. Nathan explained to Kirsta, one may regard this as a kit which Talbot has devised, entitled Karen Novotny. It might even be feasible to market it commercially. It contains the following items. 1, pad of pubic hair. 2, a latex face mask. 3, 6 detachable mouths. 4, a set of smiles. 5, a pair of breasts, left nipple marked by a small ulcer. 6, a set of non-chafe orifices. 7, photo cutouts of a number of narrative situations, the girl doing this and that. 8, a list of dialogue samples of inane chatter. 9, a set of noise levels. 10, descriptive techniques for a variety of sex acts. 11, a torn anal detrusor muscle. 12, a glossary of idioms and catchphrases. 13, analysis of motor controls.
Science fiction, SF, it's a term which is often freighted with embarrassment, both for those who own up to liking it and for those who own up to practising it. Do you want to be known as even partly an SF writer at the end of your career?
Well, I certainly did write science fiction when I started out. Given my interests in science and technology, given my interests in change, because the 1950s were a time of tremendous change. You know, the blueprint of the world we live in now, jet travel, consumer society, the TV landscape, was laid down in the 1950s. I saw change around me in Britain in the mid-1950s when I began to write. And I thought, how can I reflect this accelerating change? Everything is sort of being transformed. And yet, that wasn't reflected in the pages of the novels being written in the 1950s. So I more or less had to start writing. There was nowhere else within the science fiction world then. Of course, SF then, as Kingsley Amis, to his credit, pointed out, was going through, I think, its sort of greatest and most serious period. When one thinks of, present-day science fiction, particularly as seen in the cinema, it's really fantasy of a very kind of lurid and over-the-top kind, invaded in part by horror fiction and by the occult fiction. I mean, it's almost totally mindless. I mean, I certainly began as a science fiction writer, but I haven't really written any science fiction since the late 60s. I mean, I don't consider novels like Crash or High Rise or Concrete Island to be science fiction. I mean, I'm very proud to have written. Began my career as an SF writer because I still believe that science fiction is probably the authentic literature of the 20th century. I think it's the only form of fiction that has really responded to sort of technological and scientific change. I think it's the equivalent of the sort of folk tale of the 20th century. It has a sort of direct line to the unconscious. This is where sort of archaic myth surfaces in the form of, the scientific and technological imagination. Its influence has been enormous. It's, on advertising, fashion, film. So much of the landscape of the imagination these days is dominated by SF, certainly in film. I mean, if you look at a list of the most successful films ever made, probably, 8 out of 9 of them are SF films, most of Spielberg's, for example. Mm-hmm. One very important thing science fiction has done is to break down the rigid separation between various sort of media, between, say, film and the printed word. Mm-hmm. Science fiction elides that difference. You move almost seamlessly from the printed word into the film through the TV series in a way that doesn't happen with the mainstream novel.
You've spent much of your writing life, it seems, in Shepparton here, deepest suburbia, as a widowed father, bringing up your children, sending them to school each day, getting them dressed and getting them to university and so forth. And your explanations of these, you know, abnormal, extreme limit conditions of reality seems to proceed from an incredibly, have proceeded from an incredibly normal lifestyle. What has been the relationship between your inner world and the world of your writing life?
Well, I've tried to persuade people I am normal, you know, whatever the term means or whatever its limits. I mean, people over the years, particularly since I wrote Crash, have come to see me here expecting a sort of miasma of drugs and child molesting, and they're amazed to find that I'm a whiskey and soda man. I brought up my three children, happy, very happy children. I had a golden retriever and a cat and, a couple of gerbils and a pet rat. They found all ordinary domesticity. But in a way, I'd like to think that proves my point. The fact that an apparently sort of sane and decent human being can manage to write a book like Crash and emerge unscathed.
Or the Atrocity Exhibition or something.
Or the Atrocity Exhibition and emerge unscathed, I think proves my point that, that I'm as much a technician as, say, a pathologist carrying out an autopsy who, may be up to his elbows in human gore, but at the end of the day hangs up his rubber apron and goes home to a happy family.
You're up to your elbows in psychic gore.
Right, during the day I'm up to my elbows in psychic gore because I'm trying to carry out a kind of forensic examination of a small corner of human condition, and I'm trying to do so as dispassionately as I can.
From The Man on the 99th Floor by J.G. Ballard. Mind draining, Forbes turned to the balcony, dry mouth sucking at the air. Numbly, he jumped up onto the balcony and poised on the narrow ledge like a diver, the streets swaying before his eyes. Below, the horns were silent again, and the traffic had resumed its flow. A knot of vehicles drawn up in the centre of a small crowd by the edge of the pavement. For a few moments, he managed to resist. And then the current caught him, toppling him like a drifting spar.
One of the things that driving through Shepparton to get here, it's a question I've really been burning to ask you, and it's not just Shepparton, but it's any interurban or suburban area, when you see the semi-detached houses and the extensions and the paving stones. I just wondered what your reaction was to the Rose and Fred West scenario, because I know you've written about your fascination for Myra Hindley in the past. That seems to be the ultimate overturning of suburbia at the end of the 20th century. I mean, literally under the paving stones, the horror. I'm just interested, as a news event, how you, as a writer and as a thinker, reacted to that? Because it challenges everyone to react.
With absolute horror. I mean, as in the case of Myra Hindley and Brady, or any of these psychopaths, particularly those who prey on children, I don't know whether the Wests technically were living in suburbia. I think they were living quite close to the centre of Gloucester, but I may be wrong there. They were living in what looked like sort of typical town, terraced townhouses.
But they were DIYers, they were living in a semi-detached house.
Well, I mean, That was the ultimate in DIY, wasn't it? That was sort of DIY death. I mean, they were running a sort of one-man or one-woman concentration camp there. It was nightmarish. But I don't think the climate at any given time produces people like Fred and Rosemary West. I think, you know, the human aberrations that have always been thrown up. The real question is whether the sort of, you know, advanced high-tech societies that we live in now make it easier for people like the Wests to carry out their little evil worlds. I'm not sure if they do. I mean, we are all under enormous surveillance these days. I mean, not just from closed-circuit TV cameras in the local shopping precinct, but there are huge numbers of agencies that are keeping watch on us.
From the Atrocity Exhibition by J.G. Ballard. Holding the wound under her left breast, Nurse Nagamatsu stepped across Webster's body and leaned against the bogey of the telescope pylon. Clearing her throat with an effort, she spat out the blood. The flecks of lung tissue speckled the bright ribbon of the rail. The bullet had broken two ribs and collapsed her left lung and lodged itself below her scapula. As her eyes faded, she caught a last glimpse of the white American car setting off across the tarmac apron beyond the control house, where the shells of the old bombers lay heaped together. She tried to pull the wig off her head, then fell sideways across the rail.
There's a list of topics and icons and people and personalities about which I've always wanted to find J.G. Ballard's opinion, so I'm just going to present a list of them to you. I'm going to ask you very unfairly to respond in as succinct and lucid a manner as possible.
Go ahead.
Princess Di.
The most beautiful woman in the world, without a doubt, who's lost her way, I think. But, I mean, I remember saying when I watched the royal wedding to friends that she came from a troubled background, and I wondered, you know, what the future would hold. In fact, she's come out of it magnificently, and it's the House of Windsor around her which has collapsed into a sort of neurotic and rather pathetic mess.
Bill Gates.
His impression, I mean, this is so paradoxical, is a sort of super nerd, and yet he's one of the richest and most successful men in the world. Maybe in the future all men will be like Bill Gates.
Good for the game. Plastic surgery.
It's rather touching to see that people, you know, can place their faith in remaking themselves, remaking their innermost selves by tinkering with the outermost layer of, you know, their bodies. It's only, you know, to be deplored when people, you know, feel they need to all look the same. And a lot of Hollywood starlets do begin to resemble one another. You know, they come off a kind of production line where personal idiosyncrasies and quirks of character reflected in the face are cut away, you know, with the surgeon's scalpel. That's a shame.
Genetic engineering?
Again, it's something with all sorts of frightening possibilities. I mean, parents in the future are going to be able to select, you know, the characteristics, the psychologies of their offspring, down to a talent for flower arranging or psychopathy or whatever is fashionable, you know, at a given time.
Would you like to have had that option?
No, I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad that I had to rely on just the, you know, the shuffle of the gene pack, and that nature, you know, made those choices.
Return of communism in Russia.
God, do people never learn? I mean, it's a sign of desperation, isn't it? That the older Russians, I think it's mostly confined to the elderly, you know, should long for the days of absolute certainty on the police jackboot.
You've always seemed to have evaded left and right. Is that deliberate?
Evaded? In what sense?
I can't really pin you down to any particular political position. Ever. I mean, you see, one point seems to contradict the other. In the kind of...
Well, it's just that sort of British party, you know, party politics has never kind of matched my own sort of outlook on the world, partly because I wasn't brought up here, and I find the perpetual division between sort of Labour and Tories, it's a very British thing. It doesn't sort of translate into, you know, the sort of my more international background that I had. And also, it reflects the English class system, I think, in particular, because I don't think it's so much a sort of Scottish phenomenon either. There's something about, I mean, the English are stuck with this class system, which has a powerful hold on life here and shapes almost every aspect of life here. And, I mean, we're one of the few countries in the world where, you know, the class system is an instrument of political control. You know, the Americans have a class system. It's not so evident, but they do have one. The French and the Germans and the Danes and so on all have, you know, stratification of some kind. It's here alone. The class system is an instrument of political control in a way that it's not in America. It keeps the hoi polloi down at the other end of the lifeboat, while, you know, the upper classes sit clustered around the captain with one hand on the tiller and the other hand on a large revolver. Now, until, you know, the class system is dismantled, I don't think there's much, you know, I think this country condemns itself to a sort of second-class status.
Greenpeace.
I think that's another branch of the Children's Crusade. I think it has, you know, very little to do with the reality. I think it's rather dangerous in many ways because single-issue fanatics are able to manipulate, you know, the mass media in a very skillful way, and they can set agendas that hide all sorts of obsessions of a rather, you know, dangerous character. In fact, my last book, Rushing to Paradise, is exactly about, you know, the hidden agendas that lie behind sort of extremist fringes of the ecological and feminist movements.
It's the one book that you've written, and I'm glad you've brought it up, where the brushstrokes are a little broad, and Dr. Barbara, who's the kind of the crusading eco-feminist who wants to create a man-free matriarchy on this island of the albatrosses, which she's trying to save. It's the one book whereby I feel as if you're thumping an anti-environmental tub, or any kind of tub, rather than exploring the issues.
No, I think that's unfair. In fact, I enormously admire Dr. Barbara Rafferty in Rushing to Paradise. She's loosely based on one of my heroines, Margaret Thatcher.
And, I didn't know that.
I tried to sort of, you know, convey something of the energy and shrill drive of the younger Margaret Thatcher, the Margaret Thatcher of the early 80s, in the way Dr. Barbara behaved. I admire Dr. Barbara, and as I, you know, described her behaviour in the novel, I found myself totally in sympathy with her. I mean, I would have followed her to the, you know, to the end, or whatever.
From Rushing to Paradise by J.G. Ballard. The threat of a new series of atomic tests had failed to inspire Dr. Barbara, a veteran of the protest movements, who was helping to run a home for handicapped children in Honolulu. This restless and high-principled English physician was bored by the endless rallies against ozone depletion, global warming, and the slaughter of the minke whale. But Quimon also informed her that the French engineers of Saint-Esprit had extended the military airstrip, destroying an important breeding ground of the wandering albatross, the largest of the Pacific seabirds. Saving the albatross, Dr. Barbara soon discovered, held far more appeal for the public. The great white bird stirred vague but potent memories of guilt and redemption that played on the imaginations of the University of Hawaii graduate students who formed her protest constituency. Coleridge's poem, she often reminded Neil, was the foundation text of all animal rights and environmental movements, though she was careful never to quote the familiar verses.
Of all the political movements in the world which I would have hypothesised that you would be most opposed to as a futurist and a progress fiend, it would be the Luddite end of the ecological movement. I mean, is that your
ultimate
countervailing force?
Absolutely. I'm intensely pro-advanced technologies. Obviously, you can't fill the Thames with dangerous chemical wastes that kill every fish and every plant. I mean, one's got to regulate the activities of industry and of scientific research so that the community as a whole doesn't suffer. But, we've benefited so much from the advance of science and technology this century that it seems absurd to artificially decide on a cut-off point. Some sort of anti-technology, anti-growth people would like to do.
We're here on the occasion of your book of essays, A User's Guide to the Millennium. I'm not sure whether that's this millennium or the next millennium. I presume it's the next millennium.
Yes, I think it's the next millennium. I mean, the title is also the title of one of the longer pieces in the book, which is a look at the science fiction film, and of course it relates there to the next millennium. But it occurred to me that most of the topics covered in the book together constitute the sort of baggage that we'll carry with us across the threshold of the next millennium. Hollywood stars like Marlon Brando and Marilyn Monroe, great scientists like Feynman and Einstein, the hydrogen bomb, in the arts, people like Warhol and Francis Bacon, writers like Burroughs, together constitute the cultural baggage we carry. So that in a sense it's, the last few years, the last decades of this millennium, and they're reflection in the first decades of the next.
And if new technology would enable you to double your lifetime, would you go for it?
Yes, obviously, given the alternative, yes. the quality of life is terribly important. I mean, it's a mistake to think that you can live to the age of 90 without, and maintain the kind of friskiness of a 60-year-old. But obviously, health on all sides has improved so much. We're all, thanks to better food and better medicines, we're all probably much younger than our chronological ages anyway.
So the SF writer wants to live forever?
I'm still living in the future, and I hope to go on living there.
J.G. Ballard, thank you very much.
face.